Mercer Administrator versus Commissioner James P. Hackler, Appellant Counsel, Eric F. Shell, Appellant Counsel.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Jim Magner. I represent the appellant, Ms. Lynn Mercer, Administrator of the Estate of Brentwood. And if it may please the court, I would like to reserve a few minutes, 5 minutes, if I could, for rebuttal. I don't know if it's going that way or how it's going this morning, but if I could, I'd like to do that. Your Honors, this case comes before the court on appeal from what are actually two final orders from the Circuit Court of Loudoun County dismissing two defendants, both on grounds of lack of personal jurisdiction. It's a little bit convoluted because one of those orders dismissing the co-defendant, not the defendant appellee that is still in the case, the second appellee has settled their case and are no longer part of the case. But looking back at the orders in the way that this case was approved for appeal, the errors 1 and 4. 4 dealt with a conspiracy claim against the two defendants, one of whom is still in, to the extent that the court has any interest in that issue, knowing that the law firm defendant is an appellee, he has been settled out of the case. I simply rely on the brief on that matter. So I don't think it still applies, but the two don't necessarily match up 100% if you understand what I mean. The error number 4 and the order dismissing the defendant don't necessarily line up. So I'd like to focus my argument this morning on the appellee who is still in the case, Ms. McKinnon.
And am I correct, the only provision of the 801.328.1 that you rely on is subsection A4, is that right? The persistent course of conduct.
Persistent course of conduct is certainly one of them. There are a couple of areas of jurisdiction I argued to the circuit court.
Right.
I think I raised them in the brief. The first is that one, persistent course of conduct.
Okay.
And that has to do with the causing tortious injury in the Commonwealth. That's the tort basis for personal jurisdiction.
Because there's A3 and A4. A3 is causing tortious injury by an act or omission in this Commonwealth. And A4 is a persistent course of conduct. I mean, there's other stuff in there, but that's what... Now, look at your assignment of error, and it says that you did not engage... that Ms. McKinnon did not engage in a persistent course of conduct and therefore subject to in personam jurisdiction. So, you know, we just have to methodically look at all your claims in the statute. So clearly, A4 is directly in the sign of error. It's cited. Help me in your brief where you develop A3.
A3 is the tortious injury.
Right.
Your Honor, I believe in my brief, looking back through, I may have convoluted the two bases because in the complaint, if you look at the civil complaint, we allege a number of things, some of them torts, some of them other types of claims, breach of fiduciary duty, and what have you. So for the tort, it seemed to me that the fact that she physically came to Virginia, engaged in this conduct, took money out of bank accounts, changed names on bank accounts, caused that tort of conversion. It's no different, I would think, than if she had simply driven through on her way to Florida to go to Disney World and had a car accident. It's a tortious injury. One is a negligence tort, one is an intentional tort, but they're both tortious injury.
Right.
And it would be, I think it would be questionable to say that if she had caused a car accident here, that she could not be held liable because she...
Right. I understand all that. I just am trying to figure out what's properly on appeal. I don't contest that there's a perfectly good faith, sensible argument to be made that jurisdiction was proper over this defendant under 801.328.1A3. My concern is I'm looking for that argument in your brief as opposed to A4. our analysis is confined to A4, then let's talk about, do we have persistent course of conduct? Does that clause apply? If A3 is in play, I'm trying to figure out where that's argued in the brief.
And I apologize, Your Honor, because what I was dealing with was a circuit court that convoluted both of those. And going through his analysis, if you look at the transcript, said, here's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at the statute calls for persistent course of conduct, and I think that means an ongoing string of business, and therefore on that base I'm denying jurisdiction. And that was his ruling as to all of my claims for personal jurisdiction.
Right.
So on appeal, I was arguing in basically in contradiction of that, that that was an incorrect reading of the law, that there is personal jurisdiction over this defendant under several means. But in addressing what the trial court had, trial court's ruling, the issue on appeal, as I understood, was that the trial court's ruling was incorrect, and it was incorrect on that basis as well. I don't think that you can simply deny jurisdiction on somebody who comes to the Commonwealth and engages in what was a persistent court transaction and also commits a tortious act in the Commonwealth.
I don't want to take up all your time.
Understood. Understood. And
How do the facts alleged here? I thought McKinnon hasn't had any interaction with Virginia since her Prince William County case ended.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. And so what happened with the Prince William County case is it ended because the person who was subject to potential guardianship and conservatorship passed away. And under the 64.2 section, there's no jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, over that case anymore when the person passes away. So the Prince William County Court simply said it's moot, and it lost subject matter jurisdiction over the determination of who will be appointed to be this person's guardian because the person was deceased. What's interesting there is that the order which allowed Ms. McKinnon to take control over half of the assets was an interim order with no bond requirement or anything else, simply upon her her statement to the court that she would be subject to the court's jurisdiction. So when the court mooted that case because subject matter jurisdiction went away on the death of the decedent, then the question is, what happens to the interim order? Well, you have an either-or situation. Either the order goes away because it's simply an order, which, interim order is not a final order, so therefore, Ms. McKinnon's right and authority to control those assets went away. She no longer had authority, and that money has to come back. Or it's a court order, and it's a standing court order that was issued, in which case Ms. McKinnon is still controlling those assets subject to that court's jurisdiction. So either way, those assets have to come back. And that would be, that was the point that we were trying to make to the circuit court in Loudoun County. The reason we moved over to Loudoun County is because part of the case in Prince William, we disposed of the real property of Prince William. So when it went to probate, the only real property left in the estate was in Loudoun County. They owned property in both counties. So the probate had to take place in Loudoun County because of the real property, and that's where it came back up. That's why it didn't go back to Prince William. But that interim order going away as moot left us with an either-or situation. But the answer to both situations is either she's still under their jurisdiction, or she's got to give the money back because the money was under the jurisdiction. Clearly, everybody agreed the money was.
Can I ask you there, because that touches at the heart of it, either one, they're still under the jurisdiction, or two, what's number two?
Number two is that she's lost the authority of that court to control those assets.
Okay,
those assets.
Why would, I'm not reading this file for a number three argument. The number three argument is she purposely availed herself of the judicial power of Virginia by entering into the Prince William County litigation, and that no matter how it was ended, and no matter what this res judicata effect or non-effect is, she came to the state on this exact topic and sought judicial power to be exercised over your clients. But that, when I got to that section of the brief, that's what I was thinking you were going to say, but I didn't see you saying that. Am I reading you too narrowly?
It may be, and I thought I had made that point fairly clear, that in going through the analysis, not only did she apply to the court for that power, but when she lost at trial, she then appealed to this court and filed an appeal here. So she continued on even after.
But under the purposely availing doctrine, it doesn't matter whether you appeal or don't appeal. It doesn't matter what the collateral estoppel or res judicata effect. None of that matters. The only thing that matters is you showed up, you submitted yourself to the power of the court. In fact, in this case, you requested the power of the court to be exercised.
Yes. In my purposeful availment argument, that I made in the brief was more targeted at the other defendant because there's other grounds, additional grounds for jurisdiction against Ms. McKinnon separately with regard to her interactions with the law firm and using the law firm to hold the funds that she was given was where I had directed the purposeful availment. But the purposeful availment, I think, underlies all of the Volkswagen cases and all of the Supreme Court cases subject to how you can be made to answer in a foreign jurisdiction. And that being, go back to the statutory section on persistent contacts with the state or minimum contacts with the state or causing tortious injury in the state. All of those, I think, are underpinned by that principle of she availed herself of the law of the Commonwealth. You avail yourself of the law of the Commonwealth when you drive through the state to go to Disney World. You avail yourself of the law of the Commonwealth when you engage in contracts with people in the Commonwealth. You avail yourself of the law of the Commonwealth when you file a lawsuit here. That's what happens.
When you're physically present and take any number of steps that are allegedly tortious.
That's correct. And in fact, I pointed out, I think, in the brief also, that one of the business transactions she engaged in while she was here was to get a power of attorney over the decedent.
I mean, the hard cases are the ones where you have someone who's distantly located, who's doing one thing or another, sort of remotely into Virginia. You know, they put something in the stream of commerce or doing something over the internet or over the telephone. She's physically there engaging involuntarily in litigation. There's no special appearance saying you don't have jurisdiction over me. She's here.
Right. And I think what the argument that was made by the defendant appellee at trial was that that was for a very specific purpose. And if I understand that logically, I could see where if I drive through the state on my way to Florida, that doesn't necessarily give somebody jurisdiction over me in a business transaction or some other type of thing. So it has to be related. But here it's directly related. She got control of these funds, first by the power of attorney and then by the authority of the court, and then decided afterwards, when it didn't go her way, I no longer wish to be part of jurisdiction. And I don't think the person should be able to pick or choose one way or the other.
Right, I mean, the only oddity is the lady passed away, and then the Prince William County land was taken care of, but it's all one bundle. It ended up in two different courthouses.
Right, and that's what, when I cited the cases, the D.C. Virginia Department of Juvenile Justice case, it's kind of an oddball case. I don't think we had something that I could find in Virginia that addressed this particular fact pattern, but I could see it one that's actually could happen more in the future because we have a lot more people moving to the Commonwealth, particularly in Northern Virginia, from other countries under various visa arrangements and other things, that you could very well have these situations where you have a guardianship that's an out-of-state guardianship, and then the person dies in the middle of the process. And so then it raises that question of, is it a thing decided? And I don't think the thing was ever decided. I don't think it was ever decided, the disposition of those funds. Because even in the case that we won in Prince William County, the court bifurcated the issue of the money because it involved the husband's funds. Well, in a weird quirk of facts that is probably unique to this case, the husband then also passed away. So it's like double convoluted than it could have otherwise been. But I think the principles are the same. And I think that case law there on when the court asserts jurisdiction, once it asserts jurisdiction over a matter, it should retain jurisdiction until that matter is resolved. And I think the point that I was trying to make is that matter has never been resolved. And she voluntarily subjected herself to personal jurisdiction of the court to begin with to get control of those funds. And until the disposition of those funds is resolved, whether it's resolved through probate if the person passed away, or whether it was actually resolved by the Prince William County Court through conservatorship, there has to be some seeing it all the way through to the resolution. And so that's what we were asking for the court to do in Loudoun County, because the court in Loudoun County said, well, she's a Canadian citizen, she's not here, and I don't find a persistent course of business here. And I think that was the wrong analysis, which is why we're here today.
You're down below 2 minutes. You can use your time any way you'd like.
At this point, Your Honor, unless there are more questions, I'd like to reserve anything else for rebuttal. Thank you, Your
Honor. May it please the Court. Eric Schell for the appellee, Lori Bell McKinnon. Your Honor, one of the initial problems in this matter was that Ms. Mercer did not identify in her affidavit on the service from Secretary of the Commonwealth for the non-resident defendant which provision she sought, provided the basis for long-arm jurisdiction to attach, and an in personam jurisdiction would bring Ms. McKinnon before the court. So, as the Loudoun County Circuit Court judge, we did the same. We looked down the 10 enumerated provisions by which you can act directly or through an agent under 328.1A. A1 is that she would transact any business in the Commonwealth of Virginia. That did not apply.
Why not?
That she came,
she's seeking to be power of attorney, and then she takes various actions as power of attorney. Why is that not?
She came down to look after her aunt, who was in a demented state when her husband had been placed in an emergency room.
Where is the either the statute or the case law that indicates that transacting business means commercial?
She was seeking to be appointed as a conservator and guardian of her aunt. That's not transacting business, Judge. I think that's using the...
Tell me the case.
I do not cite a case to Your Honor.
Okay. What about A3?
A3, Judge, was the tortious injury to act or omission inside the Commonwealth.
Right.
The Prince William County Circuit Court, on an emergency petition, had awarded an interim order granting Ms. McKinnon's responsibility and control over certain assets of Eleanor Wood,
right,
and Ms. Mercer control over certain assets of Mr. and Mrs. Wood. That was a lawful order permitting her to act on her aunt's behalf, utilizing those funds with monthly reports to the guardian ad litem that had been appointed for Ms.
Right, but I thought the claim was she then was not using those funds for those purposes.
She was, in fact, using those funds for the purposes, because the whole idea was that there was parallel litigation filed. Ms. Wood was a dual citizen of the United States and Canada. Her home place was Prince Edward Island, Canada. Her family was in Canada. She owned property in Canada, family, home places in Canada. So there was a parallel litigation that was filed in the Canadian province of Prince Edward Island.
The claim is allegations of misappropriation of funds belonging to... you may be right that, in fact, your client used the funds in an entirely appropriate way, but at least that's the... looking at the complaint, that was allegation. That was this sort of abuse of this power of attorney. So, but then that... need to be resolved by a court, whether who's right and who's wrong?
One of the problems in this matter is, as Your Honors know, when you appear, especially you're not allowed to participate in the litigation,
right,
discovery, so there couldn't be requests for admissions suggesting that the guardian ad litem had not objected to the expenditure of funds, or that the court had made any determination in the underlying case that there had been any misappropriation or misuse
on
the funds that had been allocated,
right,
to her. And so you have to take it on what is alleged in the complaint, and what it essentially says is two things. There was an order, interim order, entered in the Prince William County Circuit Court, guardianship and conservatorship matter, that gave her lawful authority over certain funds of Eleanor Wood, which funds she used to retain a law firm in Prince Edward Island to prosecute the interests of her aunt in Canada. So that's what you have.
Counsel, I want to go back to the question answered?
Yes.
I want to go back to the transacting business. She gets power of attorney, goes in front of the Prince William County Circuit Court, and seeks and receives an order telling Middleburg Bank, you can't do certain actions. You can't. These funds have to be held. Okay. How is communicating, going to a bank, instructing a bank, getting a court order to prevent a bank from doing something, how is that not transacting business in the absence of any prior law from this court that limits the term transacting business? I mean, I looked up the term transacting and the verb to transact, and I looked up the verb the noun business, and frankly, it looks like it could fit.
I'll tell you why, Judge. I think that even if you reason that is transacting business, that transacting business in the jurisdiction of the Commonwealth of Virginia over the person of Lori Bell McKinnon ended not later than 30 days after August of 2016, when an order was entered in the underlying clause, the only reason that she was in the United States, the underlying clause, disposing of the conservatorship matter, the guardianship matter had already been awarded to Ms. Mercer. Disposing of the conservatorship matter as moot at the request of Ms. Mercer over the signature of her accountant says, we asked for this. So that's a final order, disposing of the cause. It became final under Rule 1.1 of this court's rules. There was no appeal taken of that order. Any relationship that Ms. McKinnon had to the Commonwealth of Virginia by submitting to the jurisdiction of the Prince William Circuit Court for those discrete two matters expired not later than September 2016. She has not been back since then, alleged she has. They don't allege she spent any money since then. They don't allege that there's any, they allege that she misspent the money for her own purposes, but there's no factual basis for the allegation other than, yes, the money was spent to a law firm in the Canadian provinces to represent the interest of my aunt. Okay. But there's no fact that says she stole the money, she obtained it unlawfully, the power of attorney was void, any of the other basis so that would give this court some pause.
Your argument is that she certainly, the transacting business, that there's no basis to say she's not transacting business, but that it came to an end at some point, and therefore there cannot possibly be jurisdiction?
It came to the end from the view of the Commonwealth of Virginia in August of 2016 when the Prince William County Circuit Court entered a final order in the cause, which was the only submission to this jurisdiction by Ms. McKinnon, even as pled in the complaint, which is the only facts you have before the court at this particular time. But
can I circle you back to Justice McCullough's question? To your opposing counsel, the assignment of error on the merits is simply the trial court erred in ruling that McKinnon did not engage in a persistent course of conduct, therefore there's no jurisdiction. How is that issue even relevant to A1, transacting business, or relevant to A3, tort in Virginia? Why isn't it limited, as the rest of the brief applies it, to an A4 analysis?
I think it is an A4 analysis. I think Judge Hootkamp looked at A4 as being the only possible statutory provision that would be permissive to exercise long-arm jurisdiction over Ms. McKinnon.
Well, what I'm asking is different, and I don't know that I'm giving you something that you're not arguing for or whether I'm trying to interpret what you're saying, and it matters. The assignment of error could be answered very easily without ever addressing A1 or A2. Because it's not relevant to either one.
Correct.
And just to close the loop on A3, your point is it'd be one thing if she'd run off and bought a sports car in Virginia or some nice clothes or something. Your point is she got this power of attorney. That did happen in Virginia. But the torts, but nothing torts about that. That's a court order saying do it. Well, by golly, you can obey court orders. But it's that then the tort that she commits is that she's in Canada and she's using the funds improperly, according to allegations of the plaintiff, to retain this Canadian law firm and engage in Canadian litigation. Well, that tort, if it is a tort, was entirely one that occurred in Canada.
Correct.
Okay, all right. I'm just trying to understand the
position. Which is why I think that the Loudoun County Circuit Court focused on A4. Which was, right. If there's a tort that was committed, it was committed in Canada, especially with the allegation of the conspiracy with a law firm. And then if the tort was committed in Canada, then there had to be some regular solicitation of business or engaging in any other persistent course of conduct or derive substantial revenue from goods used or consumed in the Commonwealth. So I think the court went to that second criteria. That's
and then you just look
external
at...
External tort, but you have to have some minimum context. Otherwise, we have a constitutional problem with the 14th Amendment.
And then it becomes a line drawing over the extent of the context. Does that cross the line over into persistent versus sporadic or versus isolated or whatever?
And what I believe the court found was that her persistent course of conduct in the Commonwealth was a discrete and finite appearance, submission to jurisdiction in Prince William County Circuit Court to participate in her petition, cross-petition for conservatorship and guardianship of her incapacitated aunt, and that that matter had concluded and that she had not had any other conduct in the Commonwealth of Virginia after the closure of that discrete litigation.
But do you see how the concepts are being confused here? Because the idea of voluntary submittal is the idea that you don't have jurisdiction over me under A1, A2, A3, A4, A1000. There's no personal jurisdiction. Due process even says there's no jurisdiction. But you still show up. So for all the reasons Justice Mims was asking you, why wouldn't all those concerns say, yeah, she's submitted to the jurisdiction of the court, and it doesn't really matter to us whether or not she would have been within the jurisdiction of the court had, in fact, there been no voluntary acquiescence. But she did voluntary. She not only submitted to the jurisdiction of the court, she asked for proactive relief. And your point is, well, that case ended. And my question to you is, frankly, so what?
Because she didn't submit to the jurisdiction of the Commonwealth of Virginia for the remainder of her lifetime for in personam attachment under any theory of liability not otherwise specified in 801.328.1.
What about, okay, I got that, but what about she did for the narrow purposes of resolving the issues that the Prince William County litigation was meant to ultimately resolve?
No question. And the final order was entered, and that cause, not appealed, extinguishing the action. Now what Ms. Mercer wants to do is to take her administration of Eleanor's estate and acting under apparently the power of attorney of her late father and convert those into a new cause of action and suggest that Ms. McKinnon had submitted herself to the jurisdiction.
Let's assume this hypothetical. Two litigants, neither one have any jurisdiction, any due process or long-arm jurisdiction over them in Virginia. And a business dispute arises, and litigant plaintiff sues litigant defendant, submits to the jurisdiction, litigant defendant does not raise a personal jurisdiction or long-arm defense. That gets non-sued. Then the day after the non-suit, and it doesn't get appealed, obviously, and the day after the non-suit, defendant two, who submitted to the original claim by plaintiff, files what otherwise would have been a counterclaim, but was never filed. Why wouldn't the court say to plaintiff, who's now defendant in the second action, you can't raise personal jurisdiction now. You were just here yesterday asking for me to exercise personal jurisdiction over this very dispute. What's wrong with the logic of what I'm leading to?
Well, I would have to know the distinct causes of action that were being alleged, whether it be tort or contract or some other
matter. Well, let's say it's generally the same dispute, but maybe having different cause of action labels.
Then I think, as we asserted, we would say that it was barred by res judicata because you had to bring under one cause
of
action.
But that's a completely different issue of personal jurisdiction. You don't get to that until after you determine you have jurisdiction.
I don't think that you can waive your right to complain about in personam jurisdiction under our long-arm statute if the matter that brought you here distinctly under that statute has been completed and is now final, and that if you want to assert another claim against me under our long-arm statute, you then must comply with the two-step process. Do one of these 10 criteria bring you before the court? And does it offend constitutional due process to have you answer here? And while she submitted to the jurisdiction for the conservatorship and guardianship, she didn't for the estate matter. She
so
didn't.
Where do we, your argument seems to me to be a very reasonable argument. The counter argument seems to me to be a very reasonable argument. So we're needing precedent to decide the tiebreaker, if there is a tiebreaker. And no, neither side argues that there's precedent on point, that a later litigation on exactly the same subject by the other side, you can use the voluntary submitted jurisdiction doctrine to moot out the question of personal jurisdiction. In your research, did you have anything more to add to that question?
No, other than the fact that the litigation in Prince Edward Island still continued after the entry of the final order of Prince William. Such that if the claim were to, could have been, should have been made against Ms. McKinnon, they could have been brought in the Canadian province of Prince Edward Island, suggesting that she had misused the funds that had been authorized under a legitimate lawful order of the Prince William County Circuit Court, and they should be disgorged or refunded, or a judgment should be entered against her. And that never took place, Judge.
Okay, fair enough.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal?
I want to bring up three very quick points. First is that I think it's disingenuous to say that the tort took place entirely outside of Virginia. That would be tantamount to saying that a roofer who comes to Virginia after a big storm and collects money from people in Virginia and then returns to North Carolina and then says, you know what, I'm not going to be a roofer, I'm just going to keep the money here, has committed the tort of conversion in North Carolina.
But your son of error says absolutely nothing about A3. And most of the argument says absolutely nothing about A3.
No, the assignment of error, in perhaps I inartfully phrased it or brought it, argued it, the problem with the assignment of error was that the trial court took that persistent course of business as a catch-all for a reason why we can't have any jurisdiction. Went through the analysis and decided, well, we don't have a persistent course of business. That means X, Y, and Z, and therefore there's no personal jurisdiction, and denied all personal jurisdiction on that basis.
Well, I'm not criticizing that you made the assignment of error. I'm criticizing the assignment error you didn't make, which is the court was wrong on A4, and the court should have agreed with me on A3 and didn't.
Right, but and I think the point that I was trying to make was that the court used its analysis on A4 as a reason for denying all of the bases that we brought. Because we also argued at the trial court that the probate statute under the carrying money away from the estate was provided a separate basis for
jurisdiction. I do have a question because I think I'm sort of thoroughly confused by all of this. What was the argument that you made in the trial court? Was the argument that you have jurisdiction, Judge, because she has voluntarily come to Virginia, filed a suit in Virginia, availed herself of the Virginia courts, and so therefore you have jurisdiction? Or was your argument before the trial court A4? And how do we get an assignment of error that just focuses us on A4?
We made all of the first part of your statement is what we argued. Plus, we also argued there were other statutes like the probate statute and other statutes that provided for jurisdiction outside of 8.01. There were other statutes involved that also provided for jurisdiction. We made all of those points. What we interpreted and what I think the court did was say, this under A4, I've got no jurisdiction, so that's it. And that's the only analysis that the court made.
But where does your assignment of error carry this court if we would agree with you? She came into Virginia, she filed suit, she availed herself of the court. She can't now say, but Virginia, you have no authority over me. But we would agree with the court, perhaps, that there were not the requirements of A4 of engaging in persistent course of conduct are not met. Let's say the trial court was wrong, but there is no other assignment of error before.
Right. And what I'm trying to say is that the fact that let's say the trial court was right on A4, and I don't agree with that, but let's say they were. My point is that the fact that they're right on A4 doesn't mean that there was no personal jurisdiction. That wasn't that's the only hat the court hung its decision on. And my point was that's not correct. Even if it were correct, it's not the only basis for jurisdiction. There should have been personal jurisdiction over this defendant for other reasons.
Shouldn't there have been another prong to your assignment of error, and the trial court was wrong in dismissing our case?
Well,
because there was jurisdiction.
And I don't want to get to the point where I'm arguing semantics, because I think what I felt the trial court was doing when I interpreted what the trial court was doing was using that argument as a catch-all for every argument. There's no argument for personal jurisdiction under any form because I don't find this. And my counterpoint is no. There are other reasons why there should be jurisdiction. I listed those out. She came to Virginia. She actually came here. She engaged in transactions with the bank. She engaged in getting this power of attorney. Power of attorney by itself says it shall be construed under the laws of Virginia. So I pointed out this out to the court. She did all of these things. These are all basis for jurisdiction, not just this A4 transacting business in the Commonwealth. And so the court's error, I think, was in using that.
I think you answered Justice Powell's question, and your time has expired.
I apologize. Thank you.
Call the next case.